Good morning. Happy Sabbath to all of you. Well, I'm excited to share some stories with you guys this morning. I hope you're excited to hear some stories. My dad likes to tell stories in his sermon, and I kind of take after him. But before we begin, for those of you who would like to follow along a little bit, I'm going to spend some time in the book of Colossians. Specifically, if you want to turn to the first chapter of Colossians, will be in verses 15 and 17 in just a few minutes. Colossians 1, verses 15 and 17. Something is going on in the Colossians church. Chapter 2, verse 9, seems to indicate that the church has demoted Jesus and made him kind of not equal with God. According to Paul, they were struggling with immorality. I'm not going to read the list, but there's some pretty horrific things there. I'll read some of what he says. He says, "Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming. You used to walk in these ways in the life you once lived, but now you must also rid yourself of all such things as these: anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. Do not lie to each other, since you have taken off your old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge of the image of its creator." There was division in the church. Paul advises them in verse 13 of chapter 3 to bear with each other and forgive one another. Why would he tell them that if they weren't doing that already? There's some problems in the Colossian church. Sound familiar, right? Our world today, we see lots of problems in our church. The community was falling apart. They had lost sight and hope and power. Darkness was taking them over. They had faith. Paul states as much in chapter 1, verse 3, but something was missing. Why else would Paul write a letter to the Colossians? So what does Paul do? He could have told them what they were. He could have berated their behavior. They certainly deserved it. He could have called for new leadership, shunned them, hit them over the head with, insert whatever proverbial stick you like there. But what does Paul do? He presents Jesus. And now we get to chapter 1, verses 15 and 17. "The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation, for in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together." This is before Paul ever gets to the problems of the church. Before he ever mentions anything to the Colossians about what's wrong with them, he gives them Jesus. I love the vision, the perception God gives to Paul. He sees what is missing. He sees that what they had lost was their sight of Jesus. No, they no longer wondered after him. They were perhaps distracted by the things in their life. I know how that goes. Paul says in chapter 1, verse 3, that he knows they have faith in Jesus, that they love the saints, but something is wrong. Paul reasons that if they can be shown again the wonder of who Jesus is, what he has done, they cannot help but be rejuvenated in his spirit. No distraction can stand in the face of who Jesus is. So Paul takes them to the beginning. This is where we should start as well. We need to begin by filling our minds with the wonder and the glory of Jesus. Why? Because no distraction, unity problem, or false teaching can stand in the glorious light of Christ Jesus. Perhaps today we are making Jesus too small. Are we doing similar things as the Colossians? Do we see Jesus for who he really is? Do we have faith but are missing something? If so, where could we begin? How about, let's start at the beginning. Genesis 1, verse 1. "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." In verse 16, he says, "And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. That's what the Bible says. This is what Paul was talking about. It seems so simple. God created the sun, moon, and stars. We all know that. My three-year-old son knows that. But what are we missing? I know I skipped a few days of creation. There's a lot to cover there, but I want to dwell on this particular thing because we can kind of get the scope of things. Even if I were to describe these things as they really are, we would not completely understand it. We live on a small planet. We are very small on the planet. It's truly difficult to understand the scope of things. So I'm going to be shrinking the work of God to more human scale. We're going to be on a scale of 1 to 1.4 billion. All right? On this scale, the Earth would be about a half a millimeter, a little less than a half a millimeter. But because I don't quite think you'll be able to see that from there, I have made it a little bigger for you. See, there's the Earth right there. All of the planets on our scale, from Mercury to Mars, are kind of the same size. They're all really small. Jupiter is the first one that you might actually be able to see, and maybe Saturn a little bit after it. You know, that's a 5.4 millimeters on our scale, and 4.4 millimeters. The rest of the gas giants don't even quite make 2 millimeters. So that's our scale. That Pluto is over here, by the way. Whether or not it's a planet or not, I still drew them there. I used a pen. I just put a dot there. And even that dot is still too big. On our scale, you wouldn't even be able to see Pluto. And the same thing goes for the moon. At this point, I'm going to need my dad to come up and help me with the next part. Because once we start getting past the planets, we actually can start to visualize a little bit. And so I've prepared some visuals. There we go. Our sun, being the closest star to us, would clearly appear to be the largest star in our sky, but in fact it is relatively small in the scope of stars. Nonetheless, it measures in at a healthy and visible 20 inches in diameter. I'll help him put that up for a second. So here's our sun, compared, of course, to our oversized Earth. It's a bit bigger. We'll put that here. That's great. But as I said, our sun is actually relatively small in the scope of stars. So we're going to put up a couple of more stars here to kind of give a little bit of perspective. Alpha Centauri is the closest star to our sun. It's only 4.3 light years away. And it is slightly larger at 24 inches. It is an orange giant. Yep. But we're still actually kind of small. The brightest star in the night sky, some of you may know, is called Sirius A, not to be confused with Sirius B, C, or D. And it is larger still, giving off a blue light covering 35 inches. Compared, of course, to our Earth, which is less than half of a millimeter. There we go. Unfortunately, we're still not quite getting the scope of things. I mean, those are pretty big circles, but I'm going to need Mr. Knight to come up and help me with this next one here. Compared to our Earth, all of these stars indeed make me feel very small. However, there are much larger stars than this. For the next star, we'll need the ladder. Pollux, a yellow-orange giant, measures in at a whopping 15 feet on our scale. So we'll see if the gentleman can put it up there for us. So we'll put it on this side here, Kent. About there. Now we're starting to get it, aren't we? Don't forget, this is us, an oversized us. That's a pretty big sun. Hopefully that stays up there. But even Pollux is not overly large. It's not really big. Our next star is actually two stars, so it's kind of cheating, I guess. It's easily remembered by its name, which I'm sure you all know, VFTS 352, which I know you're all familiar with. It's a contact binary star, literally two stars that are touching each other. Its diameter on our scale, 23 feet is where this one stops. Unfortunately, we're going to run out of room. The ceiling's only 20 feet tall, so it's going to hang down a little bit. But I definitely feel like we're getting somewhat of the scope. I mean, that's a big star. There's our sun over here. This is our sun. That's a big star. Here's us, the oversized us. Are you starting to get some of that wonder back? When Paul said, Genesis says God created the stars, that's all it says. God created the stars. It doesn't give us any idea of the scope of what these stars are really like. That's a gigantic star. While they're wrestling with that, I actually have a little bit more, because that is still a relatively small star. So for the next one, I'm going to have Louis stand up on a spot on the floor here. We're going to compare Louis to the stage. So Louis is actually VTFS 352, again, but instead of vertically, we have to now move horizontally. So he's the white star there. He's the binary star. He is 20 feet from the stage. But next is Arcturus, an orange giant, the brightest star in the Herdsman constellation. It is 41 feet from the stage. But we're still not quite getting there. The next star is kind of a famous one. Its name is Polaris. It's the North Star. On our scale, it is 61 feet. And this is Guy with his blue star here. It's a blue star. Don't forget, this is us. From the stage to there. Yeah, we're doing better. The next one is truly a big star, though. We got Bjorn here. He's got to go out to 75 feet, which is the next line there. This is Aldebaran. Actually, it's not that famous of a star. Nobody really knows about it. It's in the Taurus constellation. It's not particularly bright for any particular reason, but what it's famous for is that its size is the same as the orbit of Mercury around our sun. So if this sun were our sun, Mercury would be inside the sun. But we're still not quite there. So actually, if I could get Jessica to take that flashlight, it's a bit further. We'll talk about Rigel. Actually, this is kind of a famous star for Adventists because it's the brightest star in the constellation Orion. It's said that Jesus will return to the belt of Orion. It is 105 feet on our scale. Nearly takes my volunteer out the door. I've given her a flashlight so you can see kind of better where she is. So she's standing at 105 feet. Oh, it's Anders who's got it. 105 feet. Don't forget, this is the oversized us. Are you starting to reclaim some wonder when it says God created the sun, moon, and the stars? This is what he created. This is what we know. This is the biggest thing in our sky. But that is the star that God created. Go ahead and come sit down. Thank you very much, volunteers. However, even on this scale, no building can contain God's greatness. This building is not big enough to show the stars that God created. Antares is larger still. A red supergiant measuring in at 1,464 feet on our scale. That, by the way, is the orbit of Mars. Flying over house and field and trees, if you were to go straight to the office of the Sterling Ridge Apartments, you would be at the diameter from our stage to there for this star. But God didn't stop there. Betelgeuse, another red supergiant and the second brightest star in the Orion constellation, measures in at 1,816 feet and puts us on the intersection that they just built down the road. But that's still not it. The biggest star that we know of, the grand prize, goes to UY Scuti, a red supergiant 1,000 times larger than our sun. The size of the star nearly reaches the orbit of Saturn. And if we were to put a marker for its diameter from the edge of the stage to the far edge of its diameter, we would have to stand on the front steps of the hospital, 2,929 feet from here. This star is so large, by the way, that at the speed of light, If you were to travel around its equator, it would take 7 hours to make that trip. For reference, to travel around our sun at the speed of light, 14.5 seconds. This is the wonder Paul was trying to get the people to see. God created everything. It's amazing. There are some other things that Jesus does, though. I'm going to tell you a story about myself and then a story about someone else, and then we'll get back into the Bible again. I spent a summer fishing in Alaska, one of the funnest summers I ever spent, the hardest I ever worked ever. One day we decided, instead of staying on the inside of the inside passage, to go on the outer side of the islands. We'd heard that the fishing was good over there. We also knew that the islands do something very kind for the fishing boats that are inside, and that is they buffet the waves and the wind a bit, and so it tends to be a bit calmer. The average size of waves that we would encounter on our 50-foot boat rocked us gently, and we're only about maybe 3 to 5 feet. On the outside of the island, we encountered some serious waves, what I thought were serious waves. The boat was approximately 20 feet high from the gunwales to the top of the cabin, and the waves were nearly at eye level when you were standing at the top of the cabin. So the waves were probably about 15 feet. That's a substantial wave. That's big enough that our 50-foot boat would tip at nearly 30 degrees either direction when it went into the trough and out of the trough. But for fun, it was a seining vessel, and so you can't just go in one direction. You have to drive in a circle to close the net. And so, in order to close the net, you have to turn the boat sideways to the waves. And those waves were coming awful fast. And that boat, front and back, was at 30 degrees. Side to side, it was at 60 degrees. I was standing on the back, stacking the cork as it comes in over the top of the boat, and the pile gets higher and higher and higher. And by the time you're done stacking the cork, you by yourself are probably about 10, 15 feet above the water's surface. And on a boat that's tipping 60 degrees, you can imagine how far I was traveling in either direction. I was sick, literally, all over the net, just all the time, throwing up just as much as you can think of. Stack some more net, throw up some more, stack some more net, throw up some more. This was my day. Until I slipped. And in my rubber boots and rubber gear, because it was raining like I've never seen before, and the wind was blowing like I've never seen before, I fell off the boat. Thankfully, I also, at the same time, caught my foot in the net. I swung down and around and landed on the bottom of the boat where the captain was. He looked up and looked at me, and I looked up and looked at him, and I smiled and I got back on the net and kept stacking. That was the scaredest I've ever been. Because had I fallen in the water at the speed and the rate the boat was moving, and the speed and the rate the current was going in the opposite direction, with my rubber gear, they probably never would have found me. That would have been it. And that was a very small storm. I'm going to read to you a story written by Matthew Teague in Smithsonian Magazine in July 2017. The name of the story is The Mobile Bay Sailing Disaster. This is a story about people who know what they're doing on the water. The Dolphin Island Regatta first took place more than half a century ago and hasn't changed much since. One day each spring, sailors gather in central Mobile Bay and sprint 18 nautical miles south to the island, near the mouth of the bay in the Gulf of Mexico. There were hobby cats that could be pulled by hand onto a beach. There were also sleek, purpose-built race boats with oversized masts, the nautical equivalent of a turbocharged engine, and great ocean-going vessels with plush cabins below decks. Their captains were just as varied in skill and experience. A ripple of discontent moved through the crews as the boat circled, waiting. The day before, the National Weather Service had issued a warning. Here's the warning. A few strong to severe storms possible on Saturday. Main threat, damaging wind. One of the sailors was recorded as saying, "We get these reports all the time. We sail anyway. We sail with the wind." Now at 7:44 a.m., as sailors began to gather in the bay for a 9:30 start, the Yacht Club's website posted a message about the race in red script, canceled, due to inclement weather. But at 8:10 a.m., strangely, the yacht club removed the cancellation notice and insisted that the regatta was on. They would later insist the cancellation was an error. All told, 125 boats with 475 sailors and guests had signed up for the regatta, with such a variety of vessels that they were divided into several categories. The confusion delayed the start by an hour. A false start cost another half an hour, and the boats were still circling at 10:45 a.m. when the Weather Service issued a more dire prediction for Mobile Bay. Thunderstorms will move in from the west this afternoon and across the marine area. Some of the thunderstorms may be strong or severe, with gusty winds and large hail the primary threat. Only 8 boats withdrew. On board the Razor, a 24-foot boat, 17-year-old Leonard, his father, and 3 friends scrutinized incoming weather reports in granular detail. The storm appeared likely to arrive at 4:15 p.m., they decided, which should give them time to run down to Dauphin Island, cross the finish line, spin around, and return to home before the front arrived. Just before a regatta starts, a designated boat carrying race officials deploys flags and signals and horn blasts to count down the minutes. Sailors test the wind and jockey for position, trying to time their arrival at the starting line to the final signal so they can carry on at speed. Leonard felt thrilled as the moment approached. He and his father, Robert, had bought the Razor as a half-sunk lost cause and spent a year rebuilding it. Now the 5 crew members smiled at each other. For the first time, they agreed. They had the boat tuned just right. They timed their start with precision, no hesitation at the line, and they led the field for half an hour. The small catamarans were among the fastest boats, though, and Kyla, the name of the boat, Kyla, hurtled Hannah, 15 years old, and Ron, 61, forward. On the open water, Hannah felt herself relax. Within a few hours of the start of the 2015 Dauphin Island Regatta, as boats were still streaking for the finish line, the storm front reached the port of Pascagoula, Mississippi, 40 miles southwest of Mobile. It slammed into the side of the Menomina, a 600-foot oil tanker weighing almost 57,000 tons, and heaved it aground. During the first half of the race, Hannah and Ron chased Ron's brother, Shane, who sailed on an identical catamaran. Halfway through the race, Ron made a bold move. Instead of sailing straight towards the island, the shortest route, he tacked due west to the shore, where the water was smoother and better protected, and then turned south. It worked. "We're smoking," he told Hannah. Conditions were ideal at that point, about noon, with high winds, but smooth water. About 2 p.m., as they arrived at the finish line, the teenager looked back and laughed. Ron's brother was a minute behind them. "Hey, we won," she said. Typically, once crews finish the race, they pull into harbor at Dauphin Island for a trophy ceremony and a night's rest. But the Gaston brothers decided to turn around and sail back home, assuming they'd beat the storm, and others made the same choice. The brothers headed north along the bay's western shore. Shortly before 3 p.m., he and Hannah watched as storm clouds rolled together towards them from the west. A heavy downpour blurred the western horizon as though someone had smudged it with an eraser. "We may get some rain," Ron said with characteristic understatement. But they seemed to be making good time. Maybe they could make it to the Buccaneer Yacht Club, he thought, before the rain hit. By now, the storm, which had first come alive in Texas, had crossed 3 states to reach the western edge of Mobile Bay. Along the way, it developed 3 separate storm cells, like a 3-headed hydra, each dense with cold air and icy particles held aloft by a warm updraft, like a hand holding a water balloon. Typically, a cold mass will simply dissipate, but sometimes as a storm moves across a landscape, something interrupts the supporting updraft, pouring air to the surface. The hand flinches, and the water balloon falls, a downburst pouring cold air to the surface. "That by itself is not an uncommon phenomenon," says Mark Thornton, a meteorologist and member of the U.S. Sailing, a national organization oversees the race. "It's not a tragedy yet." During the regatta, an unknown phenomenon, a sudden shift in temperature or humidity, or the change in topography from trees, hills, and buildings to a frictionless expanse of open water, caused all three storm cells to burst forth at the same moment as they reached Mobile Bay. And right on top of hundreds of people, Thornton says. That's what pushes it to historic proportions. On Mobile Bay, the downburst sent an invisible wave of air rolling ahead of the storm front. This strange new wind pushed Ron and Hannah faster than they had gone during any point during their race, at times as much as 13 knots. A camera on the Dauphin Island Bridge, a three-mile span that links the island to the mainland, showed the storm's approach around 3 p.m. When was it supposed to get there? 4:30 p.m. Around 3 p.m., white caps foaming as wind came over the bay, and beyond that, rain at the far side of the bridge. 45 seconds later, the view went completely white. Under the bridge, 17-year-old Sarah Gaston, Ron's daughter and Hannah's best friend, struggled to control a small boat with her sailing partner, Jim Gates, a 74-year-old family friend. "We were just looking for any land at that point," Sarah said later, "but everything was white. We couldn't see land. We couldn't even see the bridge." This is not snow, by the way, it's rain. That's how heavy the rain is. The pair watched the jib, a small sail at the front of their boat, ripping in slow motion as if hands of some invisible force tore it from left to right. Farther north, the Gaston brothers on their catamarans were getting closer to the Buccaneer Yacht Club on the bay's western shore. Lightning crackled. "Don't touch anything metal," Ron told Hannah. They huddled on the center of their boat's trampoline. It's a two-holed boat. Sailors along the edges of the bay had reached a decisive moment. "This is the time to pull into shore," Thornton said later. "Anywhere, any shore, any gap where you can climb onto land." Ron tried. He scanned the shore for a place where his catamaran could pull in if needed. The walled-off western shore of the bay offered no harbor. Less than 2 miles behind, his brother Shane, along with Shane's son Connor, disappeared behind a curtain of rain. "Maybe we can outrun it," Ron told Hannah. But the storm was charging toward them at 60 knots. The world's fastest sailboats, World Cup boats, couldn't outrun this storm. Lightning flickered in every direction now, and within moments, the rain caught up. It came so fast and so dense that the world seemed to reduce to a small gray room with no horizon, no sky, no shore, and no sea. There was only their boat and the needle pricks of rain. The temperature tumbled as the downburst cascaded through the atmosphere. Hannah noticed the sudden cold, her legs shaking in the wind. Then, without warning, the gale dropped to nothing. No wind. Ron said, "What in the world?" But a spontaneous roar drowned out his voice. The boat shuddered and shook. Then a wall of air hit with a force unlike anything Ron had encountered in a lifetime of sailing. The winds rose to 73 miles per hour, hurricane strength, and came across the bay in a straight line like an invisible tsunami. Ron and Hannah never had a moment to let down their sails. The front of the Kyla rose up out of the water so that it stood for an instant on its tail, then flipped sideways. The bay was only 7 feet deep at that spot, so the mast jabbed into the mud and snapped in two. Hannah flew off, hitting her head on the boom. Ron landed between her and the boat and grabbed her with one hand and a rope attached to the boat with the other. The boat now lay in the water on its side, but the trampoline, the boat's fabric deck, stood vertical and caught the wind like a sail. As it blew away, it pulled Ron through the water, away from Hannah, stretching his arms until he faced a decision that seemed surreal. In that elongated moment, he had two options. He could let go of the boat or Hannah. He let go of the boat, and in seconds, it blew away beyond the walls of their gray room. The room seemed to shrink with each moment. Hannah extended an arm and realized she couldn't see beyond her own fingers. She and Ron both still wore their life jackets, but 8-foot swells crashed on them, threatening to separate them or drown them on the surface. The two wrapped their arms around each other, and Hannah tucked her head against Ron's chest and found a pocket of air free from the piercing rain. In the chaos, Ron thought for a moment of his daughter, but as he and Hannah rolled together like a barrel under the waves, his mind went blank and gray as the seascape. Sarah and Jim's boat, which is Ron's daughter, had also risen up in the wind and bucked them into the water. The mast snapped, sending the sails loose. "Jim," Sarah cried out, trying to shift the sails. Finally, they found each other and dragged themselves back into the wreckage of their boat. As authorities scrambled to grasp the scale of the storm, hundreds of sailors on the bay struggled to survive it. The wind hit the Lutheran's razor so fast it pinned the sails to the mast. There was no way to lower them. The wind flipped the boat, slinging the crew into the water. Then the boat barrel rolled, and Leonard and Brown were briefly scooped back onto its deck before the keel snapped, and they were tossed once again, this time in the other direction. Brown struggled in a raincoat. Leonard, a strong swimmer, swam around the boat, searching for his dad, whom he found with Jacob. After about 20 minutes or so, towering 8-foot waves threatened to drown them, and Leonard struck out for the shore to find help. Normally, a storm's hard edge blows past in 2 or 3 minutes. This storm continued for 45 minutes. An experienced sailor named Larry Goolsby, captain of a 22-foot boat named Team 4G, was inside of the finish line when the storm came on. He and the other two crew members had just moments to ease the sails before the wind hit. The gale rolled the boat over twice before a much heavier 40-foot vessel hove into view upwind. The bigger boat was moving with all the force of the storm at its back and bearing down on the three men. One shouted over the wind, "They're going to hit us," just as the bigger boat smashed into the Team 4G, running it over and dragging the smaller boat away. The crew members had managed to jump clear into the water just before impact. Similar crises unfolded across the bay. 10 vessels sank or were destroyed by the storm, and 40 people were rescued from the water. 6 sailors died that day. It was one of the worst sailing disasters in American history, and nobody saw it coming. The Bible tells of such a storm. The Bible gives precious little details about the storm, so the story we just heard might help our imagination. It does give some background, however, of the men in the boat, hardened sailors, experienced fishermen, and they were scared to death. Mark describes the event in chapter 4, verse 35 through 39. "That day when evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, 'Let us go over to the other side.' Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along, just as he was, in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him," and here's how we know they were scared to death, "'Teacher, don't you care if we drown?' Jesus got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, 'Quiet, be still.' Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm." End story. But we put that story into a little box. Jesus stood up and calmed the storm. But think about the story I just told you. And now think about Jesus calmed the storm. In an instant, it was calm. There was no wind. Peace. Amazing. Do you think the disciples were filled with wonder? Who was this Jesus, really? Even the wind and the waves obey him. What happened next? The Bible only tells us that they continued their journey and reached the far shore where more amazing things happened. I can imagine what the boat ride was like to the far shore. Quiet, thoughtful, filled with awe at this man who seemed to have no bounds. Wonder. Their minds were exhausted and filled with the wonder of Jesus. You know, some people can create wonder. When I was young, we lived near Seattle. Some vacations would bring us to Walla Walla, where my grandparents lived. But every summer guaranteed a trip to Walla Walla. And summer was the best time to go. And the best thing about Walla Walla in the summer was visiting Grandpa. Not just his house, which was great, but at his work. You see, Grandpa made ice cream. But he didn't just make ice cream. He was the Michelangelo of his profession. He won state awards for the masterpieces that he constantly created. His ice cream was served to 3 U.S. presidents. Grandpa made all the ice cream for the old college dairy on the campus of Walla Walla College, on the corner of 4th and College Avenue. Today, it is a parking lot. But then, it was every kid's dream come true. Grandpa was Willy Wonka, and I had a golden ticket. We would always go in the back door to where he made the ice cream. Chrome machines and whirring motors, none of which I knew what it was or what it was doing. But I did understand that they made ice cream. The best ice cream. And it was all free. Oh, the wonder. Until he retired in 1986, there would always be ice cream in the freezer, and it was always from the college dairy, and we never paid for it. I took ice cream for granted. Grandpa made every flavor I could think of. Bubblegum, which I didn't really like, but ice cream that tasted like gum, cool. Strawberry, vanilla, chocolate, of course, but also black licorice. It was made in the good old days when dyes actually worked. It was black and made your tongue black, too. Cool. My relationship and love for Grandpa will always be associated with ice cream and how important it has been for all of us in my family. Grandpa brought happiness to a lot of people in the community, and for some it was frozen comfort on a day when they really needed a scoop. People don't eat an apple after having a bad day. Kids don't chase vegetable trucks down the streets of their neighborhood. They don't scream for candy. They scream for ice cream. And my grandpa made ice cream. Oh, the wonder. I can't imagine how many smiles and sounds of laughter Grandpa created with his job. The same smiles and joy heard from one generation to the next. Just another day's work for Curtis Lindsay, ice cream superstar. Here's another example of wonder, a little closer to home, even than that. Legos. Levi is getting to the age where Legos are very interesting. We first got him Duplos, a bigger version of Lego, which, awesomely enough, connects with Legos, by the way, and they are made by Lego. He loves building with those. He would build towers, garages, roads, anything he could think of, he would build it. Amazing things. Daddy, look what I built, a train. Daddy, look, I built a road that takes my car to the garage. I built the garage too. Sometimes it was good he told me what he was building so I knew what it was, but they were always amazing. Somewhere we picked up a few Lego pieces, just a few, like 10 or 15. As Levi grew older, he played less with the Duplo, but increasingly became more interested in those Legos. It is difficult for us to have Legos around because Luke will eat them, but Levi loves Legos. So I did what any loving father would do. I went to Walmart and I bought Levi a kit, a semi-truck with a flatbed hauling a combine tractor. And for those of you who know Levi, that was right up his alley. Wow, he went nuts with joy. But he didn't know how to build it, so I built it for him, with him. Some of the best 30 minutes I have spent with Levi. The thing is, once you build the kit, that's it. There's nothing else to do with it. You can play with it for a while, but the excitement soon wears off. It is somewhat unsatisfying. I would love to take Levi to the Lego store. I have been a few times myself, but have never been able to take Levi. Perhaps some of you have never been to a Lego store, so I will describe it for you. The store is like this. You walk in, and on either side is a wall of shelves. And the shelves are covered in kits, expensive kits. Every kind of kit imaginable. Truck kits, car kits. The Eiffel Tower is a kit. The White House is a kit. The biggest one I saw was a starship from some movie, $500. We are never going to own that one. Kids walk down the store, heads bouncing back and forth. I want to take Levi there. I can just imagine him running back and forth. I want to build that one. I like that one. Can we get that one, Daddy? I want to get that one. But that is not what we are at the store for. Those kids seem wonderful, and some of them are amazing. But they ultimately will not satisfy Levi, the builder of roads and garages. I will be strong. I will guide him past all the kids to the back wall. What is the back wall? This is the best part of a Lego store. The entire back wall is bins full of random pieces in every color. All the pieces Lego makes you can find on this wall. You get a bucket, and for a price, you fill the bucket with whatever pieces you want. Oh, the possibilities. Kids stand in front of the wall with their little buckets, shaking. I want to take Levi to the back wall and witness the wonder on his face. Everything he can imagine is now possible. Wonder. Oh, that we can walk our kids to the back wall, not let them settle for the kits to the left and to the right that will ultimately not satisfy. Just walk them to the back wall and say, you want wonder? You want your mind exhausted by the possibilities? Here's Jesus. Don't settle for the small things. Don't settle for kits. Run to the back wall, where you will find your mind exhausted every day by his beauty and his love. Wonder. We need to go to the back wall every day and find our joy complete in Jesus. Before we stand in front of our students, our friends, coworkers, family, that guy in the store, that lady in that car, the person sitting down the aisle from me in church, before any of that, we need to fill our minds with the love of Jesus that passes understanding. Wonder. We need to remember that Jesus is the God of creation. He can create new hearts for us and make us new. We need to remember that Jesus calms the storms in our lives. We need to remember that Jesus is the source of flavor in our lives. We need to remember to go to the back wall and see Jesus every day. And here we come to our text for the day. Ephesians 3, verses 17 through 19. And I pray, says Paul, that you, being rooted and established in love, may have power together with all the Lord's holy people to grasp how wide and long, how high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know that his love surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of the fullness of God. Paul leaves the Colossians with these words, a perfect description of Jesus. So I will as well. Colossians 3, 12 through 15. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourself with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bear with one another and forgive one another if any of you has a grievance against someone. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, since as members of one body, you were called to peace, and be thankful. It seems to me, Paul understood the wonder of Jesus. Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us, to him be glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen.